one of Australia's most recognisable broadcasters is facing the biggest battle of his life. Alan Jones has pleaded not guilty to multiple historical sexual assault charges, and now the case is before the courts.
I'm not going to dwell here on the allegations made about me, other than to say that I refute them entirely.
As witnesses step into the box and the evidence unfolds, the Case Of podcast will be your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Search the Case Of podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
It's the 17th of December 1967 and you sit down in front of your telly. Maybe it feels a little bit like a novelty to turn on the news to hear this announcement. It is feared the Prime Minister has drowned. By the next morning, the ABC is telling you there is now a firm realisation that there is no hope of finding Mr. Holt alive. By the 22nd of December, any hope of finding Harold Holt's body has been totally lost. Harry had just 692 days as PM, but if he didn't die, he may not have even made it to the next election as PM anyway. Hello, I'm Lee Boucher.
And I'm Alicia Simmons.
We're a couple of very serious historians who are letting loose in an ABC studio gossiping about dead people from Australia's past on this aptly named show, The Dead Can't Sue. And Alicia, this week we're finishing the story of handsome Harry Holt. And while we do all know how it ends, with his disappearance on Cheviot Beach in 1967, I want to unpick the lead up to that fateful day. He didn't even make it to 2 years as PM and had a rough final year in office. He did usher in some major changes from the 1967 referendum and the dismantling of the White Australia policy to shifting our alliances from Britain to the US, all while leading a secretly salacious personal life.
We love that.
But I think Harry's desire to be loved and adored and his tendency towards, well, being a bit of a people pleaser meant that he didn't quite have the leadership skills to steer Australia through those tumultuous times. That's why, before he died, there was a good chance he was about to be deposed as PM.
Okay, so Lee, given all this, how much credit should we actually give to Harry for what happened in that small window of him as a PM? I mean, like dismantling the White Australia policy, presiding over the 1967 referendum, these are no small feats, right?
That's true. And there's lots of historians who kind of have debates about how much credit we should give Harry.
Mm-hmm.
And I promise that by the end of today's discussion, I'm going to give you my position.
Percentages.
But, yeah.
Good.
So don't worry, we'll get there. But we'll also be covering all those wild conspiracy theories about his death. So before we go on, a little proviso. If we use some rude words in this episode, please don't sue us. Sometimes when you're having a bit of a gossip with your friends, your lips get a little loose. Let's start with his, I guess, ascension to the office of Prime Minister. So the Sydney Morning Herald announced in January 1966 that the Patriarch has relinquished his power. And PM Robert Menzies was resigning after 16 years as Prime Minister. The SMH went on, Mr. Holt now at last gets his chance to show his mettle. A little bit like us in this podcast.
They're excited.
So Holt was sworn in as Prime Minister on January 26th, 1966. It was a very orderly transition, still a bit exciting though. And Harry was quite proud of the fact that he didn't have to step over the dead bodies of his political opponents to become Prime Minister.
It's interesting that Menzies had had decided earlier, right, precisely when he would resign. Mm-hmm. You know, not many prime ministers certainly these days mm-hmm. do that.
Yep.
And I guess by the time that he did resign, he was seen as a little fusty, right, a little out of date.
Yeah,
is that
that's,
right?
That's definitely right. Yeah. It is widely commented upon that Menzies has been in the office for long enough. And, you
he's
know,
out of step culturally.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good way of putting it. And that's in sharp contrast to Harry, who's fit. He's being photographed alongside his daughters-in-law who were wearing bikinis. He goes spearfishing. He's in wetsuits. Some even compare him to 007.
Oh, I love this. So if I'm thinking of 007, James Bond in the 1960s, we're going back to Sean Connery.
Yes.
Right? We're imagining suave, debonair, stolid, invulnerable in the face of the British Empire crumbling. Mm-hmm. He's that model, but also a figure, I guess, of kind of sexual excess, right, rather than the moral rectitude and notions of moral duty that defined Menzies. So yeah. Menzies is a father, and we have the son coming in to revolt.
And he's handsome, and he's an object of desire.
Do you know what I also love about this, I've got to say, approaching my autumn years in life, is that he's almost 60 when he's going in.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that we still call him handsome. May we long do that.
Right. He's seen as young. He still has that reputation for being a kind of informal, yeah, easygoing guy who's on the beach.
Yeah.
And him becoming Prime Minister is kind of understood as a symbol of changing times. This is a move from the conservative post-war years of the 50s and early 60s to a more vibrant kind of swinging 60s modern sensibility. And I think TV in Australia is really part of this story. So in the late 50s, only about 10% of residents in Melbourne and Sydney have televisions. And by 1965, that number's around 80%.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's an incredible increase in the number of people consuming and engaging with their world through a television set. And Harry and Zara are seen on screens.
And that also speaks of a wider cultural context, doesn't it, of post-war affluence, of leisure time, the fact that people can sit back and watch their televisions. And I'm also imagining Americanization.
Yes. You know, which is going to be a big theme of his prime ministership.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the other thing that I did in researching this episode, which I think probably was the most fun I had in doing so, was I decided that rather than, you know, looking only through the newspapers, the political commentariat and the formal political biographies, I went and looked at how he was represented in Australian Women's Weekly.
Oh, very nice.
But what's really significant here is that Harry's prime ministership isn't just about Harold Holt for the Australian Women's Weekly. It's about Harold and Sarah.
Oh, interesting. Sure. Right? Okay. Huh.
So it's about both of them moving to the lodge. It's about both of them as a kind of power couple, a couple of admiration, of modernization, of intimacy and informality, in contrast to stuffy Menzies.
Nice. I find that contrast between Holt and Menzies really interesting, I guess, as well, because unlike Menzies, who would not budge on the wide Australian policy, right? But from what I understand about it, Harold Holt does.
Yeah, and this is a very kind of contested question amongst historians.
Uh-huh.
Because historians of the left don't want to give Holt any credit for dismantling the White Australia policy. They want to make that Gough and Earl Grasby.
Sure.
And historians of the Liberal Party want to say it wasn't Gough, it was actually Holt.
Right.
And look, of course, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But as PM, he does pursue a couple of really important changes to the White Australia policy. So just a quick reminder, the White Australia policy formally becomes Australian policy in 1901 when the colonies are federated. It essentially aims to maintain the whiteness of the Australian population by restricting who can and can't come here. And it stays in place pretty much for the first 50 years of Australian national history. And one of the things that he does is that he opens the door to non-European immigration. But those cases are to be determined on a kind of case-by-case basis. So there's no formal exception kind of in place.
What's the criteria that he uses?
They can't be competing for white jobs.
Interesting.
Essentially. And one of the, I think, interesting things that he does is he irons out some of the differences in policy settings for migrants who are already here, evening out who can and can't access permanent residency. So there's uneven wait times, depending on essentially how white you are, between 5 and 15 years. And he basically evened those out and says, if you are here legitimately, you can apply for permanent residency after 5 years.
Interesting. So how much of this is about Harold Holt as a person, as a humanitarian, who is looking at these cases of refugees and concerned about them, and how much is it, on the contrary, about a bureaucratic standardisation of immigration policy?
Yeah.
I think
it's the latter.
Yeah,
I don't think he's an ideologue. I don't think, you know, he's a, in one
great
sense,
humanitarian.
No, he is a pragmatist, and
the world is changing anyway. Yeah. So he's just
so we need to change a little bit too. Look, the other thing I think that's worth pointing to is his kind of thorough engagement while PM in that first year as PM with Southeast Asian political leaders. So he visits more countries than any other prime minister in Australian history up until that point. He really increases foreign policy engagement.
Interesting. So we're starting to shift more towards America and towards Asia.
Even Gough Whitlam says later, Holt did more to encourage Australia's engagement with Asia than any prime minister of the 20th century.
Although, to be honest as well, it wouldn't be hard.
It's a low bar.
I mean, British, like, you know, Menzies was so like...
Yeah, it's a low bar.
...to the bootstraps.
Yeah.
Just such an Anglophile.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's... Yeah, but it's important that he situated Australia within our own regional context.
Yeah, started to do it in a modest way.
Great.
Remembering he's a bit of a pragmatist. Yeah, let's not... Because actually, you know, the turn away from Britain, which is happening in part because Britain's turning away from Australia...
Turning to Europe, right?
Yeah, and they're pulling out of Malaysia.
Yeah.
And when Britain makes that decision, Holt tries to argue against it. He tries to convince the Brits to stay in Malaysia, to stay engaged in the region. You know, so he's still committed to the kind of, in one sense, close relationship with Britain, but Britain's not as committed to the close relationship with Australia. And so he has to go looking for new friends.
Yeah.
And he's not making new friends in South Asia. He's making new friends with America.
Okay, so tell us about LBJ.
Yes.
That's how I know Holt, is that all the way with LBJ. Tell me about that.
It's actually, you know, in one sense it's a kind of apocryphal sentence because that sentence is muttered, well, it's not muttered, it's said quite proudly actually, when he's kind of in the throes of a bromance with LBJ. Oh. He's visiting, they're engaging on foreign policy questions, on questions around Vietnam, and his response to a question around Australia's support for US engagement in Vietnam is, we're all the way with LBJ. And actually, I read that and think about what it's like to be in the throes of a bromance of a new friend who adores you, and they sort of understood each other. They had a similar politics.
Yeah.
I can kind of see how you'd end up saying something a bit silly.
Yeah, absolutely, throwaway line. And also, I guess, again, that wider context is he's a people pleaser and he knows at this stage still that most of Australia is supportive of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, he comes home and, you know, people are kind of taking the mickey out of him for saying it. And he does regret it.
Right, interesting.
But he doesn't regret the policy. He thinks continued support for the US in Vietnam is a bit of a no-brainer and he's not alone. So there's an election at the end of 1966. So this is a year into his prime ministership. And one of the central issues differentiating the ALP and Holt's government is the question of Vietnam and the question of the use of ballot to conscript young men into the army. Holt produces a pretty stunning electoral victory. Right. So, you know, obviously elections aren't about just one thing.
Yeah.
But that election is a pretty good barometer of how deep support for is amongst many Australians for a continued involvement in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the change in that attitude, which happens quite quickly in 1967, that causes him quite a few problems, I think.
So let me just recap on this. We've got a handsome Harry. He's now riding high at the end of 1966, having won a resounding record majority in the election at the end of the year. He's making these kind of incremental reforms. What are the other reforms? What about the, the 67 referendum that you mentioned earlier in the podcast? Tell me about that.
Look, 67 is an incredibly momentous year in Australian history.
Yeah.
And it's the year when over 90% of Australian voters vote yes in a referendum, which essentially will mean Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders people will be counted in the census and that the Commonwealth will be able to make laws about them.
Sure. Although, as I recall from the advertisements at the time, said things like, vote yes for Aborigines.
Yeah.
You know, vote yes for equal rights.
Yeah. So, like, I'm going to defer a little bit to you as my legal historical friend. Let's be honest. You know this history a little bit better than I do. But, you know, those constitutional changes are actually quite small.
Yeah.
They don't a great deal in terms of substantive changes to the lives of First Nations Australians, but they are understood at the time to be quite large.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, interestingly, people had been calling for these changes since 1910, a number of Aboriginal organisations in the 1950s arguing for the changes. My understanding is that if you look at the reality of it in terms of actual practical changes. You go, what it did was allowed for the Commonwealth now to make laws yep. around Indigenous people, which did not improve their condition, but simply led to a shifting of responsibility mm-hmm. from the states to the Commonwealth back to the states. Yep. You know, if anything, it actually, in some ways, made things worse. The interesting part is that the representation of it is actually quite different, and we have to separate the legal realities, I think, from the cultural transformations that it ushered in and that it signified. So tell me about those.
Yeah, so it meant a lot in terms of how, you know, that 90% number is really significant.
Yep.
And the campaign leading up to this referendum didn't say this is for some minor tweaks in the constitution.
Yeah.
This is about whether or not
yeah.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are part of the Australian yeah. nation.
Interesting.
This is about whether an Indigenous child and a white child
yep.
have the same value.
Yeah.
And so it was framed around equality. It was framed around membership in the yeah. national community.
Yeah.
And this was a ringing endorsement of that question, right? So First Nations constitutional legal scholar Megan Davis, while noting a quite limited scope of the change in legal terms, right, argues yes, that we shouldn't underestimate the impact of the yes vote, both on non-Indigenous Australians and on Indigenous Australians. And she writes,
interesting.
Even though Aboriginal people were legally entitled to vote in federal elections before the referendum, it was only after the referendum that many felt able and willing to exercise that right.
Wow.
Although the vote did not establish Aboriginal peoples as Australian citizens, as they already possessed that legal status, it did mean that many saw themselves in this way for the first time. And they were treated by more members of the community as if they possessed such rights.
Wow.
I think that's a really nice way
absolutely.
Of, you know, it's a really kind of very nuanced historical reading. I will just say one more thing, which is if you count it in the census, that impacts how electoral boundaries are drawn, because that's how they determine the number of people per seat. So if Indigenous people aren't being counted in the census, that means they're not being counted in terms of the division of electoral boundaries. So if you have a very large Indigenous population, that seat will have many more people in it than the census would represent if you don't count Indigenous Australians.
God, such an interesting moment, I think, in Australian history. But what's Holt's role in it? Like, what's he doing, you know?
I think figurehead is probably the most
right.
generous way of possibly reading his involvement. There's another item on that referendum ballot which he cares much more about, which is about the number of seats in the lower house. I won't go into it. And actually that gets a no vote and he gets very shitty and petulant about
really?
It, remarking that Australians haven't followed the advice of their leaders, and he's really annoyed. And he makes very little comment about the referendum relating to Indigenous peoples afterwards. And in fact, when he's asked, are you going to do anything with these new powers? He says, no, the states can still continue to do what they're doing. So,
God.
So, you know, 1967 would actually prove to be much rockier for him than
right.
this kind of great beginning in 66. And I think we can see the glimmers of the explanation for why in the relationship to that referendum. That is a nation-making moment, regardless
yes.
of its legal reality. He does not identify and take leadership over that moment, and that is going to be a kind of flaw in his character that is going to really cause him some problems in 1967.
And I'm imagining Whitlam in the wings,
mm-hmm.
you know, who is able to do that, right?
Yeah, so
tell me, yeah.
The ALP leader, Caldwell, is deposed as leader by Gough after that election loss.
Yeah.
Caldwell's a pretty stodgy-looking guy. Gough's
sure.
kind of young, handsome,
sure.
charismatic. And he's absolutely doing, like, it's it's a bit like Keating and Hewson in Australian Parliament when Keating says to Hewson, I'm going to do you slowly
yeah.
and enjoy it. Gough is enjoying just making Holt get flustered. Like, Holt's getting flustered and flappy on the parliamentary
dear.
Floor. And there's a lot of reporting of that. Yeah,
yeah,
too clever by half.
Yeah.
Harry's brother Cliff dies in March,
okay.
Which is, you know, obviously devastating, yeah, although his biographer suggests that he coped with this better than you might have expected, actually.
Okay, so he's starting to get a little bit on the nose.
Yeah.
Tell me what actually happened.
Yeah, so Australian involvement in Vietnam and opposition to it is starting to grow.
Right.
He's starting to face increasingly large protests. There's a really funny moment in a protest in Perth where, you know, students and other rebel rousers kind of force him to escape running to a taxi. His press secretary has to jump in the window because the doors are shut against the student rabble rousers. You know, the tides are shifting. I know, it's great. It's really wonderful. But it's in the context of this growing opposition that Holt actually agrees to supply more material and human support for US involvement in Vietnam, even though Treasury says to him this is not a good use of money and Defence says to him this is going to make no material difference to the actual war itself.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it, given that he is a big people pleaser.
Yeah.
You know, and he's otherwise just swum with the tide and been so wishy-washy. Why is he so steadfast about
I think he sees Australia's unpopular thing? Yeah, I think he sees Australia's commitment to the US alliance as fundamental.
Right.
And I also think he thinks that the opposition to the Vietnam War is a minority. He thinks it's a loud minority rather than representative of a wide
whole view. Become by this stage.
Yeah, which is growing into at this stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's also a few cost blowouts. He's buying some aircraft from the US, not him personally.
But private jet or something.
Yeah, and it costs way more money than is suggested. Something that old story in Australian politics.
Unusually subs.
Yeah, yes, exactly, indeed. Holt tries to raise the cost of a postage stamp. And faces, he's got a huge backbench because he's had that big election victory and they're getting letters from their local constituents and so he has to back down. So again, people pleaser. Backs down under pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't say, no, we need to modernise and increase the cost of postage because that's how much it costs.
Sure.
And he has a bit of a public stoush with the leaders of the Nats, which I won't go into. But basically there's, you know, there's some stuff going on and he's starting to look a bit shaky. Gets to the end of the year, gets towards the end of 67, lots of people are noticing that he's lost that youthful spring in his step. There's reports of him looking hollow-faced and tired. And there's even reportage in overseas press that he's had a secret heart attack and not told anyone.
Oh, God.
So,
oh,
wow. Yeah, it's really funny. and there's murmurs of a leadership challenge, right? So he heads down at the end of 67 to his holiday house in Victoria's Mornington Peninsula for what he was hoping, I think, would be a reinvigorating weekend. It obviously had rather different consequences. He leaves Zara behind in Canberra and instead takes along his neighbour, and lover, Marjorie Gillespie.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, Frank Bongiorno, I read his chapter on Holt and he says he has multiple mistresses. Yep. Like, is Zara aware of these? Is this an a 1960s ethical non-monogamous relationship or is this betrayal, deceit and treachery?
Look, let's come back to that question and decide. But Marjorie is certainly not the first, you know. So and it's kind of well known privately that Harold Holt is having these affairs, and Zara knows about them. So he goes down with Marjorie and the group, which is Marjorie and her daughter and a few friends. They all head off to Cheviot Beach, where Holt goes on that fateful solo swim.
Yeah.
The others are put off by the choppy conditions. Those back beaches around Sorrento and Portsea are, I know them, they're really, like, I wouldn't go in them. Like, they're really, really choppy and difficult to swim in. Holt's enjoying his swim and without realising he's getting gradually taken further out to sea, the classic Australian story, doesn't realise. By the time Marjorie realises how far out he is, she starts to wave at him to swing back. He can't hear her saying, come back, come back, come back. And he then just disappears underneath the waves.
I feel like it's an archetypal terror for all Australians, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just the stuff of our nightmares from childhood.
Yeah, my mum's rule used to be that I wasn't allowed to go into the ocean above my belly button.
Oh, cute.
So that was her way of managing undertow. Right. And I always used to go, but is that before the waves come in or after?
Yeah.
Because you know how the sea moves up and down.
But tell me, why do you think Holt did that? Like, what does this say about his character?
Yeah, about him as a human.
Pleasing Zara, like.
Well, Marjorie. And actually, I think that's right. I wonder if he's showing off.
Oh, God.
Honestly.
It's kind of embarrassing, right?
Yep. He's showing off. Yeah. He's actually tired. He's got a sore shoulder. It's a really stupid thing to do.
God.
He loves the water, as we know, but he actually wasn't as strong a swimmer as he thought he was. That was something that had constantly annoyed Zara. She'd constantly been telling him throughout their lives, and he wasn't in great shape.
I mean, I can't help but going back to the 007 thing.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking that this is a kind of...
You know, and he'd just eaten lunch. And as we know, don't go into the water just after you eat.
Oh, absolutely.
Golden rule of Australian
Golden
life.
Golden rule.
So he's disappeared under the waves. The group calls for help and a major search begins. Marjorie's quickly sort of disappeared off the beach.
Oh, really?
To ensure that she won't be part of the press or the scene.
Oh, Trangina
hushing up that she's there.
Sure.
Zara and the rest of the family come down soon after. Nearly 200 people are searching for Holt within 24 hours. But on December 22nd, so that's about 5 days later, there's a memorial service for Holt in Melbourne with 2,000 official guests, including his bromance partner LBJ, who's come over for the funeral.
Right.
The search is called off, but on the 5th of January, his body's never found. Experts agree, basically, that he's, you know, entered the water and as the tide was turning and been pulled out. Cheviot Beach has really, you know, crazy currents, and a few people had disappeared there before Holt. So it's actually not surprising that someone would run into trouble.
Sure.
But it's actually only in September 2005 that the Victorian State Coroner finds that Holt had drowned, delivers a finding, and that's because coroners had previously been unable to investigate deaths where a body had never been found.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Lee, I've just listened to this and I find it extraordinary. I mean, a prime minister goes on a swim just by himself like a private citizen.
Yep.
It is unfathomable today to think about a prime minister doing this without security.
Yeah.
You know, what does this tell you about the office of the prime minister then?
Yeah, I think it tells us a few things. Look, he did have a guard when he was on the clock, but he refused to have one when he was on holidays, and that was both at Mornington Peninsula and also at Bingle Bay, which I think we can understand he would probably want for a variety of reasons. But I don't think it's just about his affairs. He understands there to be a strong division between public and private life, and his private life should be protected just as every other citizen's is. And Tony Eggleton, who's his press secretary, he says the following thing. This was a remarkable era for Australia. We could have a prime minister walking about, going swimming without any security protection, behaving like a private citizen, which is the way Harold wanted it. Harold's death ended a very special era for Australia, our age of innocence, because never again from that moment on did a prime minister enjoy the freedom of lifestyle that Harold did.
Do you vomit a little bit into your mouth when reading
that? I really was. Thanks for picking that up.
Age of innocence. What do you think?
Yeah, so I'm not sure we should let Holt's press secretary have the final word on what his prime ministership means. That's a partisan observation.
Yeah.
Why would Eggleton want to think in terms of innocence? Yeah. Why is he using this metaphor of innocence and Holt?
Oh, it's always used for the 60s and the 50s, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like it's,
and another way of talking about the 50s and 60s isn't as innocent, it's as conservative and rigid.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
As policing behaviour, as constrained, not as bucolic suburban freedom, but as constraint and restriction. And that Holt's, you know, prime ministership... Holt doesn't do this, but by the end of the 60s, that setup is starting to break apart, right?
Yeah, and you can see that, I guess, with his affairs.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that Holt's disappearance, and I know this myself, obviously led to a bunch of weird and wacky conspiracy theories. Walk me through some.
Okay. There's some pretty fun ones, and they actually get more weird and wacky as the years unfold.
Right.
So the first one is simply a shark attack rather than drowning. You know, that's, you know, the first conspiracy, I guess, or theory of his death that's not simply that he was a bit of a dumbo who went for a swim when he shouldn't, was, oh, he was attacked by a shark.
Can I just say quickly there, they did actually go around and kill sharks and open up their stomachs
looking for
to
his,
see whether he was inside.
I've heard that story before as well.
Yeah, I looked it up. It's true.
Yeah.
There's
morphine he was taking for his shoulder, which impaired his judgment and also physical capacity. So you can see here the beginning theories are theories about this can't be explained by stupidity alone.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But then the theory develops that it's actually a CIA assassination attempt.
Interesting. Do you know when that theory developed?
Yeah, I actually couldn't figure out when it starts to take, because, you know, conspiracy theories emerge in private, right?
I know.
So, you know, this is a history of gossip, really.
I love it. But I also wonder whether it's pre or after Watergate.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's that.
Yeah,
kind of,
it must be after.
Yeah, yeah.
So the CIA assassination theory is the idea that he was about to withdraw Australian troops from Vietnam. So it's actually the same one as the JFK assassination attempt when you think about it. Or not attempt, but successful one. But the big theory is... that he was abducted by a Russian or Chinese, most likely Chinese, submarine. And kind of squirreled away.
I love, like, the inflated significance that people give to Australia in these series as well.
Like, I love like China
the
cared
Russians
that much.
And the Chinese care.
Well, this is given further weight by actually a book in 1983 by Anthony Gray.
Right.
The Prime Minister was a spy, which suggests Holt has the whole time been a secret agent for China, and this was him being squirreled back to China before he got found out. So, look, the theories are fun.
So much more interesting.
So bananas. Yeah. So clearly not true.
Great.
Right? So clearly not true. I think I kind of, this is where I do agree with Eggleton, who says, basically, I think people couldn't accept that a prime minister could suddenly die for being stupid, right, for making a dumb decision.
Yeah. I wonder whether there is a masculinity element to that as well.
Like a refusal to accept that this had simply been Harold Holt making a bad decision because of his character.
Yeah, and that masculinist norms that are predicated upon notions of physical, you know, prowess and virility actually have really perilous consequences.
Yep. And a refusal to see that.
Yeah.
Right. A absolutely. Refusal to see. There's refusals going on in conspiracy theories.
I think so.
But theorists of conspiracy theories, they suggest that conspiracy theories emerge when people don't have faith in institutions.
Absolutely.
Right? That's and we know that we know that there's a kind of relationship between those two. And there is something to be said about the fact that these conspiracy theories gain more weight over time as Australians' faith in institutions declines.
So there's to where we are today.
Yeah, right? With everyone thinking he was abducted or whatever, you know, more and more people are believing that. Yeah. But I think at the time it's just the gap. It is just the gap of... We need something to explain this.
Yeah. And what about Zara?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to get onto it? Yeah.
I've been thinking about Zara a lot for the last two episodes in doing the research. Kind
naturally
of read her
female identified.
Yeah. Are you talking about me or her?
You.
Good. Okay. I thought so. Both identified and identifying. Like I identify with Zara. So, you know, one reading would be to turn her into his long-suffering wife.
Yeah.
You know, he's a cad, constantly having affairs. And she actually says in 1985 in a documentary, he was a womanizer. He loved them. He was a menace. Anyway, I loved him. I had to make up my mind about that very early in the marriage. And I decided, all right, if that's it, I'll look the other way, which I did.
Oh, hard.
That's hard and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But throughout her life and time with Holt, Zara isn't a kind of long-suffering wife looking the other way. Oh, I don't think she is anyway. She, who knows what conversations they had about their relationship and arrangements. Remember, their beginnings are quite sketchy, according to 1950s values.
Yeah, yeah.
And she bore Harry's children while married to someone else. They have a complicated relationship.
Sure.
And we don't know how they talk to each other. And when she's being asked that, she's being asked that in a way to turn her into this figure and she's consenting to that scripting.
Yeah.
But I still don't quite know exactly what to make of them and exactly what to make of Zara. What do you think?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I think that we are inclined to want to rescue agency in these moments, that in order to give her a fully fleshed out kind of personality and persona, that we need to give her will and that we need to give her autonomy. And in that context, we then reach for explanations like she must have consented to it. You know, they must have had these conversations. And it's quite possible that that's the case. I think it is also quite possible that that's not the case. And I think that there is real pain that comes from these things and terrible behaviour on the part of men. And I cannot help but relate it to male entitlement and to the feminist critique that came out in the 1970s of the 1960s sexual revolution, where they went, it was a sexual revolution for men, not for women. And you know what? We're done.
And also their power relationship probably changed over time.
Yeah.
Like, so the relationship between them, he becomes prime minister. He becomes the most powerful man in the country.
You're right, Lee.
So, absolutely. You know, maybe maybe certain kinds of negotiations that were possible for them in 1955, you know, like they could have changed over time.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it wasn't stable.
Yeah.
But also, you know, in terms of gender, you know, the agreement from the Australian press not to report on the private lives of politicians is deeply fucking gendered.
Absolutely.
Right? That's
Absolutely.
About not revealing the private lives of men who aren't behaving according to the moral codes that they're espousing in mm-hmm. public. Mm-hmm. And so the press are complicit mm. with these hypocrisies.
And by the press, we mean a masculinist press. We mean, like, you know, the journalists are larger
yes.
men.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting that those codes were only broken in Australia when a woman, female politician.
Without a doubt.
Yep, had an affair. Like, it was the Cheryl Kernow moment that broke that. Mm-hmm. And it was because it was a woman breaking those rules that suddenly opened. That I think that you cannot remove gender from this question of privacy and the respect of his privacy and therefore his capacity to continue doing what he was doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I completely agree. So tell me, summing it all up, how should Holt be remembered?
Mm.
Was he a moderniser?
Well, his prime ministership modernised Australia in a variety of ways. Whether or not he was the propelling agent of that modernisation, I remain a little sceptical about. Sure. And in fact, I think he didn't quite have the skills to manage that transition. I think he was a pragmatist rather than an ideologue. He wanted to people please. He wanted people to like him, whether that's Marjorie on the beach or by not causing big political fights where people will hate him.
Oh, very nice.
And I think that that meant that he didn't take strong positions. And what Australia probably needed in 1967 was someone who had a bit of gumption to take some big positions and convince the country around Vietnam, around the postage stamp, you know, around various other kinds of questions, and he didn't have that. I just will say one thing, though. He doesn't get credit for this often enough, which is he saves a chunk of rainforest in Queensland. His mate, Johnny Bust, who we met last episode, the lavatory king of Queen's College, Johnny Bust discovers that the army is about to requisition a big chunk of Queensland rainforest to test chemical weapons. Gets Harry on the phone and Harry intervenes to save the rainforest. So, you know, there is an environmental kind of element to his story, that time at Bingle Bay, which I think people don't know about.
That's good. Could have been there during the atomic testing as well.
Yeah.
In the Montebello Islands, but anyway.
Yeah, well, I don't think he had a home there.
Yeah. That's
so,
true. Oh,
yeah. But his attitude to big change, which is to do it quietly and not cause a fuss, it doesn't address the national mood that was taking shape at the end of the 1960s.
I feel like we need to advertise a Gough Whitlam. You know, biopic now.
And here comes Gough.
Exactly. You know. Final question, Lee. Mm-hmm. Biopic tagline.
I've got what a few. Uh-huh. I've had a lot of fun with this one.
Great.
Charm can only get you so far.
Ooh.
Pretty privilege, it'll get you in the end.
I love that one.
Or don't believe your own hype.
Oh, nice. Excellent. Okay.
So, Alicia, it's been a joy gossiping about Harold Holt with you. If you know someone who loves history or gossip or just two historians letting loose in an ABC studio, share The Dead Can't Sue with them. Go on.
You have some juicy gossip about someone dearly departed or just someone you'd like us to dig up the dirt on, then send us an email to thedeadcan'tsue@abc.net.au.
The Dead Can't Sue is an ABC Audio Studios production made on the land of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country.
It's produced by Hannah Jose, video producer Christian Haramano, supervising producer Hannah Riesch, and executive producer Claire Rawlinson. We've chucked a bunch of links to our sources in the show notes, so go on, do some further reading. We dare you.
I'm Lee Boucher, Associate Professor at Macquarie University.
I'm Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor at UTS.
And we can't wait to gossip about the dead again with you next week.